And now I've turned the recording on, so everything should be hunky-dory at this point. So basically, the Buddha was a prince. He lived in luxury. His father set up a system so that he never had to encounter anything unpleasant in his life. But as he got older, and this is like in his late 20s, you know, a late bloomer in terms of rebellion, I suppose, he decided to go out into the world and with his father's permission and just sort of see what's out there beyond the gates of the palace he lived in. And he went with the captain of his guard, and they're riding along, and the first thing that really strikes him is he sees this person who's sort of all bent over and crippled and frail, and he asks the captain of the guard, well, what's that? And the captain says, oh, that's someone who's old. When you get old, that's what happens. I mean, your body sort of, it's more difficult to get around and you start to lose control of things. And the Buddha's a little bit shocked because he lived in his protected world and he'd never seen anybody old. Ride on a little further, comes across someone who's lying on the side of the road and all covered in sores, and it's really looking pretty grim. And once again, Buddha says, well, what's that? And the guard says, oh, well, that's someone who's sick. You know, happens to people. As we get older, often people get sick. Even sometimes when they're quite young, they get sick and their body doesn't work so well. So now the Buddha's getting a little more disturbed. And he rides along and he comes to this procession of people, and they're carrying this sort of pallet on their shoulders, and there's a body lying on this pallet, not moving. And the Buddha says, well, what's that? And it was, well, that's someone who's died. It's a body. And taking him to the burial ground. And so at this point, the Buddha is really getting disturbed because he's never encountered any of these unpleasant things before. And he's just confused and doesn't know what to do. And then ride along a little further, and he sees this man. He's just dressed in a simple robe and he's got a begging bowl and doesn't seem to have anything else, but he just looks really happy. And the Buddha says, well, wait, all these people having these horrible things happen to them. How can this person look so happy? So he goes and he asks this man, and the man explains that he's, you know, a sadhu, a mendicant, someone who practices certain things that make him to not feel so upset, not experience the upset of the rest of the world. And the Buddha is really impressed by this and asks, well, how can I learn this stuff? And this guy tells him about this particular teacher, and the Buddha literally runs away from home because he's just so distressed. He has to find out why all this suffering is in the world. He's practicing with a particular teacher who teaches concentration, which was one form of practice in those days in India. And the Buddha quickly becomes extremely proficient, so much so that the teacher says, oh, when I die, you can be the teacher, you can teach. And the Buddha discovers that when he goes into these deep, deep states of concentration, that he no longer experiences the suffering. He's not caught up in the sadness of all of the suffering he sees all around him. But when he's not in those deep states of meditation, or deep states of concentration, everything's just the same as before. So it doesn't change. He even though he's accomplished this skill, I can concentrate really well, doesn't change anything for him. Goes to another teacher, same thing happens. Finally says, okay, this concentration stuff is great, but I need more than this. And he goes out into the forest where there's these guys who live out there who basically have decided that the best way to understand suffering is to see how much they can suffer. And they literally what's called mortify the flesh. You know, they starve, they live in a really primitive way, they struggle deeply. And the Buddha does this for 5 or 6 years. He says, well, maybe if I just suffer enough, you know, and there's stories about him living on just one grain of rice a day and nettle soup and all these stories. Decides, no, this isn't the way either. This doesn't work. He leaves these guys who live in the forest and who they think he's a real backslider for going. They see him drinking some milk, which is quite shocking, right? But in their context. And goes off and finds what he calls the middle way. Becomes enlightened. And then after his enlightenment, the very first time he taught the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths essentially were a summation of what he learned from his practice. And so what I want to talk about tonight is the first of these Four Noble Truths. And everything I'm going to say is based pretty directly on what the Buddha taught. So the first of these Noble Truths in Pali is Sarvam Dukkham, traditionally translated as the truth of suffering, or all is suffering, or the world is suffering. And I must tell you that when I first encountered Buddhism in my 20s and heard those translations, I went, ooh, basically, and walked away. Really didn't sound very appealing. I don't want to talk and think with it that the world is suffering, because I was having a pretty good time. You know, I was a bit, you know, young, somewhat wild young guy having a good time. Though obviously looking for something. The problem with this is these translations are all very poor translations. The original translations of the suttas, the Buddhist teachings, were done by a very proper Victorian gentleman. And so they had that Victorian attitude towards things. So suffering was, as far as they were, oh, great, suffering, you know, this is good. But it's very incomplete and improper in terms of the actual translation. So I want to put that aside. Literally, the word dukkha, which gets translated as suffering, has two parts. The second part, ka, just means a wheel. Just an ordinary wheel. And if you've ever been in South Asia or seen pictures of South Asia, these big ox carts with these huge round wooden wheels, that's what he's talking about, because that was how everybody got around. They either walked or they rode in an ox cart in those days. But a dukkha, so think of this big round wooden wheel, and drilled right into the center of the wheel is the hole where the axle fits. Well, a dukkha has a wheel with the hole drilled off center, so that as that wheel turns, it gives you a very sort of jerky ride. So every time the wheel turns, just like there you are, you know, jerking in your seat over and over and over again, which gets pretty annoying pretty quickly. You know, so the thing about the dukkha means basically the world is jerking me around a lot. So there's several words you might want to use. The two that I find most useful, the ones I'm most comfortable with, are dukkha means unsatisfactory or unsatisfactoriness or unreliable. They have a somewhat gentler feel to them, though they still sound kind of harsh, like everything is unsatisfactory. Still sounds a bit grim, right? And it sounds grim because in our daily lives, we don't always experience life as being unsatisfactory. And sometimes it's quite wonderful even. But what is meant is that no matter What makes you happy right now? In the moment, that something, whatever it is impermanent. It's going to go away. And that's where the unsatisfactoriness arises. It's unsatisfactory because it doesn't give us permanent happiness. It's temporary happiness. Nothing is reliable in terms of creating permanent happiness, because everything we can think of, everything, whether it's an object or an idea or a political party or whatever, no matter what it is, it's going to go away. It's not permanent in any sense. And so it can't ever make us happy. We somehow think, and here's the other problem, we somehow think it's the object that makes us happy, that somehow a certain object has a certain inherent happiness in it. So I want you to do a little thought experiment with me. I want you to think of your favorite thing to eat. You know, a chocolate chip cookie, a bowl of salad, whatever it is. Oh, my favorite. And imagine I just gave you that thing. And of course, at that moment, it's like, you're so happy, right? You're so happy. Like, oh, my great, my favorite thing to eat. And you eat it. And just as you finish eating it, I give you some more. And say, now eat this. And it's like, is that second cookie or that second bowl of salad or that second whatever, excuse me, isn't the same. It doesn't have the same effect. It's still great. That's your favorite thing, right? Wow, this is great. But you finish that whole second time, and then I give you some more. Now eat that. And by the time the third one comes along, it's just doesn't really, oh, I'm going to eat another one of these. It doesn't work anymore. So same object, same cookie or same bowl of salad, the same bowl of ice cream or bag of Doritos, whatever, same object, totally different experiences based on what Buddhists call causes and conditions. The first one was great, but by the time the third one came along, the causes and conditions have changed. I'm full. I'm tired of eating this stuff. Now that thing is not satisfactory at all. That's the nature of everything. Everything changes. Everything is unsatisfactory. But somehow or other, we keep believing that these things are going to make us happy. But think about this. Think about what goes on when you want something, whether it's something simple like a cookie or being able to go out to a restaurant again, which would be nice, right? Or whatever it is, there's the period of time before you get what you want. We don't have it. We want it, we don't have it, so we're unhappy. It's not a pleasant experience wanting something and not having it. Then there's that moment or that period of time when you get it. Great, this is happy time right now. Yeah. And then it's gone, because like everything is gone. And now I'm unhappy again because I don't have it anymore. So the strategy of somehow thinking that things will make us happy doesn't sound like a very successful idea. Not happy before I get it. Happy when I get it. That's great. Not happy when it's gone. So this is not a good method for creating more happiness in our lives or having happiness all the time. The Satipatthana Sutta, which is the Buddha's teaching on meditation, one of the things we do is actually contemplate various what are called dhammas. And the final of these contemplations is the Four Noble Truths. And I want to actually read directly from the sutta here. because the rest of my talk is really based on this, what he's saying here. So this is the Buddha's instructions. He knows as it really is, this is dukkha. He knows as it really is, this is the arising of dukkha. He knows as it really is, this is the cessation of dukkha. He knows as it really is, this is the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. So it's the first of those four instructions that I want to talk about. You know, he knows as it really is, this is dukkha. Well, what does it mean, know as it really is? And so I want to talk about three forms of dukkha, three forms of unsatisfactoriness that we encounter regularly. The first of these is the dukkha of painful experiences, both physical pain and mental pain, emotional pain. Might be brought on by an accident or old age or an illness or a breakup with someone you love or whatever. It's all, you know, these are painful experiences. These are inevitable for everyone. There's no one who can somehow magically, though we like to think so, avoid having painful experiences sometimes. This is just life. You know? And we somehow try and fight this. We try and think, no, this shouldn't happen to me. And in this struggle, in this fight with what's actually happening, we get what's called the second dart effect. The first dart is like something unpleasant is happening or happened or is happening. That's like we got stuck with a dart. And instead of going, oh, okay, I understand this. This is the way things are. We stick another dart in right next to the first dart to try and figure it out and make it better and make it go away and do all that stuff we do that just creates more problems, more unpleasantness, more unhappiness. We have to accept these things. These things are inevitable. And here's a way to look at them in a way. When you accept the inevitability of things not going the way you want, the inevitability of painful experiences, and then you realize, gee, everyone has these painful experiences. I'm not just the only one. This is something that everybody experiences. This is part of life. It sort of connects you to everyone else. It takes away some of that sense of separation because you realize everyone experiences these things. Without exception, this is the way things are. And so you can look at this in a positive sense in a way, because it sees how we're not separate, we're not different, we're not unique, we're all connected together very strongly by this sort of existential experience of unpleasantness in our lives. It's just what happens. So that's the first form of dukkha. The second form of dukkha, this is the dukkha brought about by change, as I was talking a bit more earlier on. We lose what we want to keep, whether it's my hair in my case or whatever, or you have to put up with stuff you don't want. You know, it's just because things change, things that we want disappear, things we don't like appear. It's just changes and always going on without exception. It's like a cycle of things arise, they're there for a while, they're gone. Something else arises, it's there for a while, it's gone. And we're just sort of caught in that spin cycle, in a sense. That's what's going on with life. We try and push this away. We try and make it not be true. We try and make it be other than that. But it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And so we figure we fight it. A great expression I saw once that says, we are in contention with reality. Reality is things are always going to change, no matter what. There is a great teaching that the Buddha gave about this. That is, I've had several teachers recommend to me that this is something that I might want to contemplate on a daily basis. I don't always succeed in doing that, but it's something worth considering. And this is called the five remembrances. These are things we should just remember every day to help us sort of not be in contention with the way things are. Here's the actual teachings of the Buddha. Bhikkhus, there are these five themes that should often be reflected upon by a woman or a man, by a householder or by one gone forth. What five? One, I'm subject to old age. I'm not exempt from old age. Two, I'm subject to illness. I'm not exempt from illness. Three, I'm subject to death. I'm not exempt from death. Four, I must be parted from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me. That constant change, the impermanence I was talking about. And then, I'm the owner of my karma, the heir to my karma. I have karma as my origin, karma as my relative, karma as my last resort. I'll be the heirs of whatever karma, good or bad, that I do. In other words, if we think about these things, and once again, it sounds sort of like macabre almost. Why don't I want to think about the fact that I'm going to die every day? But it's actually quite skillful, because then it becomes something like, oh, this is just normal life. This is something that's going to happen. I'm going to get old. I'm going to get sick. I'm going to die. Everything I know is going to be gone. And I'm in some level, I have to deal with this stuff. Then it doesn't seem so horrible anymore. It's just what is. It's like, and the contemplations are a way to sort of connect into that on a daily basis. Finally, dukkha, cause of dukkha number three. This is called the dukkha of everyday life. And this is like, no matter, and I'm sure you've all experienced this. You know, everything we do, we somehow try and sort of keep things together. You know, I had my spring all planned. I was going to do this, and then I was going to do that, and then this, you know, this COVID-19 thing happened, and all my plans gone, just like that. Or no matter how we try and fit things together in the material world, we somehow think I can just figure it out. If I can just fit this perfect set of things all together at the same time, then I'll be happy. And it never works, because daily life is such that there's always things changing. Causes and conditions are such that it's not going to work. We keep fooling ourselves that everything is okay, often just through lack of attention, but not really paying attention to the undercurrents of our life sometimes. We are so busy running around. We see and value all the good stuff, all the wonderful things that happen in our lives, and undeniably there are lots of wonderful things that happens in our lives. And we devalue or we ignore the unpleasant stuff. We almost like we blot it out. When I was younger, in my university days, I, like many university people, you know, young men, used to get really drunk sometimes. You know, I think it would probably be called binge drinking. You know, where you'd get so drunk you'd pass out. And I didn't do this, I mean, a lot, but like 5 or 6 times probably before I figured out why this is stupid. And the reason you did it is because it was so much fun while you were doing it. And only afterwards did you sort of go, oh, God, you know, you're all hung over. And how did I get that scab on my knee? And, you know, whatever, all this. And you wouldn't know. But then you'd forget. All you'd remember is how much fun it was and forget the unpleasantness of it. And you'd do it again. And eventually, luckily for me, I learned fairly quickly that that wasn't a way that was going to work for me as a way of being happy. And so it's an example of this dukkha of everyday life and how we keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. You know, that's there was a great expression I saw once that said, you know, that's a really good definition of insanity. You know, do the same thing over and over again, expecting to get a different result. Gee, that doesn't make a lot of sense. So there's another layer to this. There's these three things, right? The dukkha of painful experiences, the dukkha caused by things changing, and the dukkha of just living, of everyday life. And there's another part of this that I want to really emphasize because I think it's quite important. And that's that we somehow think that we suffer, that we're having these unpleasant experiences because it's our fault. I'm to blame for these unpleasant experiences. It's my fault that I'm sick. It's my fault that XYZ. Think of the thing you blame yourself for. And I want to really strongly emphasize that that's not true. Absolutely not true. And this self-blame is just another way to, remember I talked about the second dart, so we're already going through some unpleasant experience, and then getting caught in this cycle of blaming ourselves is like taking another dart and sticking another dart in. It doesn't work. It doesn't make any sense. In fact, sometimes we've actually been taught something like, that goes a phrase that's something like, everything happens for a reason. You know, this is a very, I grew up new agey hippie kind of guy, right? This was like a very hip new age thing to believe. Everything happens for a reason. This belief is one of the greatest causes of suffering in the world. Just believing that everything happens for a reason means now something's happening, it's unpleasant. I have to figure out why. I'm somehow supposed to know and do something about this. I'm supposed to be able to fix this unpleasantness. But that's not true. We don't really know why a lot of things happen. You know, this is sometimes expressed in, especially in the Buddhist world, as some sort of explanation of or definition of karma, of that action and the results of our actions. It's like everything that happens to me is because of my karma. I had an old friend a long time ago who just always was complaining of how bad her karma was, and her life was so miserable because her karma was so bad. And she just made herself incredibly miserable by believing that she was supposed to be miserable because that's what her karma was. But once again, this is something that the Buddha quite clearly spoke against. I want to read, this is from another sutta. And this is, this Brahmin Shivaka has come to ask the Buddha, you know, whether it's true that everything arises out of our karma. And the Buddha says basically no, but he says that in quite a graphic way. Some feelings, Shivaka, arise here originating from bile disorders, or from phlegm disorders, or from wind disorders, originating from an abundance of the three, produced by changes of climate, produced by careless behavior, caused by assault, or produced as a result of karma. So, yeah, karma might have had something to do with what's happening, but it's just as likely it could be you're having a bad day, or you've got indigestion, or, you know, some other thing. You know, you got assaulted, some totally exterior force. So what he's saying here is there's no way you can blame it just on karma. It just isn't true. Basically, we are affected by what you'll see in any sort of traditional literature, what's called the causes and conditions. Things arise, most of them totally out of our control, and stuff happens. It sounds simple, but that's what it is. Things happen totally. We have no say in the matter. Just stuff happens. Some of them pleasant, some of them unpleasant, some of them totally neutral. And we have to deal. We have to live with what's arising. We don't have any control over it at all. And we should never blame ourselves when something unpleasant is arising, because it's just causes and conditions. It's just stuff is happening. I'm not saying, and I want to make this very clear as well, that we should just go, oh, well, since it's all just causes and conditions, I may as well just give up now, right? Because this is where the idea of having free will, of having, we don't have control on what's arising. We don't have control of what's happening right now. But we do have control, and this is really the whole rest of the set of talks I'm going to give. We have, should theoretically have complete control over how we react to what's arising. And that's where the whole of the Buddha's teachings revolve around that particular issue. We can't control what's causes and conditions are creating what's arising in our lives at the moment. What we can learn to do is somehow have control over our reactions to those things, so that we don't keep just sticking more darts in ourselves all the time. We can somehow skillfully create the space of clarity where the unpleasant arises, or the extremely pleasant for that matter, and we don't take credit for the pleasant, and we don't beat ourselves up for the unpleasant. We just accept it. I have a favorite phrase I use a lot these days in my life, and actually I use this a lot in what I'm teaching too. It's that somehow or other, no matter what's arising, we have to be able to say at some level and really believe, and that's okay. Just that simple phrase. And that's okay. No matter what it is, it may not be pleasant. I may not like it. I may really dislike it, as a matter of fact. But I have to, at some level, be able to say, and that's okay. I'm not going to get wound up about this. I'm not going to get caught in wanting to somehow figure it out and control it. I'm just going to accept the fact that that's what's happening right now. And that's okay. And really, the rest of what I have to say over the next 5 weeks is going to be talking about how we get to the place where we can say, and that's okay. To actually be able to see that things are unsatisfactory, that they're always changing, and be able to say, and that's okay. It's like, that's what is right now, without getting caught in the emotional storms that arise often. Well, so highly frequently for some of us, perhaps. We just don't get caught there. And that's really what the Buddha taught. That's what he was talking about in his teachings. I want to read one more thing here. This is a poem by Mary Oliver from a book called Thirst. These are poems that were written right after Mary Oliver's longtime partner passed away. So they tend to be looking at life from that point of view, I suppose you could say. She's just had a great deal of suffering. Her partner, her life partner, passed away after many years of living together. And this is a poem, essentially, about that, that sort of describes quite clearly what I'm talking about. It's called Heavy. That time I thought I could not go any closer to grief without dying, I went closer, and I did not die. Surely God had his hand in this, as well as friends. Still, I was bent, and my laughter, as the poet said, was nowhere to be found. Then said my friend Daniel, brave even among lions, it's not the weight you carry, but how you carry it. Books, bricks, grief, it's all the way you embrace it, balance it, carry it, when you cannot and would not put it down. So I went practicing. Have you noticed? Have you heard the laughter that comes now and again out of my startled mouth? How I linger to admire the things of this world that are kind and maybe also troubled. Roses in the wind, the sea geese on the steep waves, a love to which there is no reply. Sort of sums up what I've been trying to say. So that's the talk portion of this event. And now I want to basically open up this whole process to